Well, we here at Musings on Golf are only here to hand out treats on this Halloween Day 2024. And what a story-filled treat we have in store for you. My name is Kelly Elbin, and my partner in our weekly show is the bewitching Bob Bupka. And now that you've come knocking, we'll be opening up with the great instructor, David Ledbetter. My good friend, my bewitching buddy, Bob Bupka, happy Halloween to you. And how great of an interview did we just have with the one and only David Ledbetter?
David Ledbetter, you know, as good an instructor, he's as good a person. And that's what really separates him. His lovely wife, very accomplished player. He's done a lot for golf, but he does it as a gentleman and carrying on all the principles that golf has been about. Nobody conducts themselves any better than David Ledbetter.
Yeah, and I learned a lot from him, Bob, in the lengthy interview that we did. I think our listeners are really going to be engaged with it. One of the things about him, he kind of referred to himself. He said, "Hey, I'm the jockey. They're the horse." And I think Ledbetter's always been that way. I mean, he has been a celebrity instructor in a way, but he's always, I think, put the player first.
You know, that's really the way it should be. It was never about David Ledbetter. It was always about his student.
No question about it. And he's had some great ones. When we come back after the interview, Bob and I are going to talk for a couple of minutes about some scary topics and maybe some sweet topics as well. You'll hear all of that right after you hear from our partners at Musings on Golf, and then a terrific interview with David Ledbetter. Our friends at William & Harry are always looking for ways to stand out in the crowd. So for anyone who belongs to a country club, William & Harry can have your shoes private labeled to fit your specific needs. The same applies to your company or any organization you might be affiliated with. This makes you a clear winner. Why? Well, you have a better quality shoe that feels great, and you have the logo of your club, company, or organization on your shoes that really makes you stand out on the golf course. To learn more, visit williamandharry.com today and be sure to input our promotional code 15OFF, M-O-G, for a 15% discount at williamandharry.com.
You flew the trap on 6. You birdied 12 and 13. You closed out the match 4-3. From your numbers to your windows, everything was dialed. That was yesterday. Outperform your best. Titleist, the number one ball in golf.
Bob, our special guest today has coached some of the greatest names in golf, from Nick Faldo to Greg Norman to Nick Price to Ernie Els to Michelle Wee. He's helped his elite students capture 26 major championships and more than 100 tournament victories worldwide. And through the GolfZone Ledbetter Academy, he can help improve your game as well. What a treat to be joined by the 2017 National PGA of America Teacher of the Year, David Ledbetter. David, you're a busy man. Thanks for taking the time to join us on Musings on Golf.
Oh, my pleasure. My pleasure, Kelly. Always enjoyed being with Bob. We've done a lot of shows in the past, you know, at Opens and everywhere else, you know, so fun to join you all.
Well, I just want to say better, nobody better than Ledbetter.
Thanks. As well, I'll use that in our promotion. Thank you.
There you go. Anyway, great to see you and hear your voice again. What a brilliant career you've, you know, put forward. And, you know, I'm proud to say I knew you way back when. Well, you were big time then. I was small time coming on the scene, but certainly enjoyed every moment that I got to spend with you. And I truly admire your way with players, just impresses me because, you know, they respect you, they listen to you, and that means you just get a lot done. And I know you did a little work with Ben Ahn, and he just won the Zozo Championship. How did you actually start working with Ben?
Well, you know, Ben went to our junior academy. You know, I was originally part of the IMG group with the academies, and it was the IMG Leadbetter Golf Academy. We now got our own junior academy under the Leadbetter name up at Reunion in Orlando. But you know, we started years ago, and Ben was part of that group. You know, we've had some really good players coming through there, obviously through the years. You know, like the Corder sisters and Ben Ahn, CT Pan, Peter Uihlein, Paula Kramer, just to name a few. And so he was part of the elite group, and so that's where I met Ben first of all, and then. When he turned professional, I worked with him for quite a number of years. That was during the time when he won the PGA, European PGA, where he shot, I think, 63 the last round to play well. So Ben's always been a great ball striker. You know, obviously he works with Sean Foley now, and they'd probably tighten things up a little bit. But it was more, you know, with Ben, it was a matter of, hey, you know, if he putted well, he's going to play well. And that was it. I mean, Tee to Green, he was always, you know, one of the better ball strikers, that always long. You know, swing looks a little bit different now. You know, it's always good to sometimes get a different take on it. So, but yeah, we had some good times, and I mean, it's nice to see him win. He won on the European tour. I mean, which is he hasn't won on the US tour yet, but I expect him to, because he's a quality player, quality guy. You know, I mean, he's got a great pedigree. His parents were both Olympic table tennis players. You know, his mother being Chinese and his dad Korean, so that was an unusual mix. Back in the day, they met at the Korean Olympics in Seoul, and so Ben obviously comes from a great lineage, and so he say he's always, I mean, the youngest winner of the U.S. Amateur, yeah, got good pedigree, and I'm sure he's going to go from strength to strength. You know, hopefully this win will boost his belief, and there's no reason why he shouldn't go out and win plenty of tournaments on the PGA Tour.
Well, David, I'm wondering about that. Is that a lot of it is just the mental side of the belief that you can win? Obviously, luck plays a factor week to week. What has held maybe a Ben Ahn back from winning on the PGA Tour to this point?
Well, there's a lot of factors. I mean, look, there's always queries and questions in this game. You know, why hasn't Rory won more majors? You know, I mean, how do you put your finger on it exactly? I mean, if the player knew, they'd fix it, right? I mean, you can have all the psychologists in the world, and it's just sometimes it's your time, sometimes it's not. It's not. Not always what you do. A lot of times it's, you know, the other players obviously in control of things. So, but I would probably say, you know, from a consistency standpoint, the fact that his putting was up and down, you know, I remember the US Open at Bethpage a few years ago. I remember the first round, I think he shot like 78 hitting 16 greens. You know, it was like something of that nature anyway. Don't hold me to exact numbers, but I mean, it was crazy. And so, yeah, putting, obviously, we know it's a game within the game. And I mean, it's really the catalyst for so many victories with players. I mean, it helps create great scores. It maintains great scores. And so you've got to have an all-round game. I mean, it's not just hitting it long, hitting it solid, and being a good iron player, being a good driver of the ball. I mean, all aspects of the game have to be working. So it's not always easy to tie these things in together. I remember Johnny Miller would say, you know, that, hey, you know, hit your irons great, you don't drive it well. Then it's vice versa. Then you get them both working together, and then you don't putt well, you know. Then you get everything working together, and it's the end of the season. So yeah, that's what Johnny would describe it as, you know, which is probably true, you know. I mean, it's trying to find everything that fits and, you know, got to have a bit of luck along the way. And I think say belief is a big part of it, though. Believing that, hey, you've done it before, you've got a history of it, and you bring it back those memories when you're playing. And consequently, if you have the talent, I mean, all of a sudden we see players, don't we, who you see, where did this player come from? And it's like, yeah, some of them, you know, the Tigers of the world, Jordan Spieth, they had this record as juniors and as amateurs and as college players. But yet you get other players that all of a sudden a Tony Finau, for instance, you know, all of a sudden just find their little niche, their belief sky high, and they go out and they win tournaments.
Such an honor to be joined by David Ledbetter, somebody I've admired a long time, not only as a renowned golf instructor, but as a person. He's always been right to your face, no playing around. Has there been a personal highlight for you in terms of a player winning a major championship?
Yeah, I suppose they're all highlights in a way. I mean, you know, they're all pretty special. You know, one of my lifelong friends has been Nick Price, and we grew up together, and, you know, seeing him win at Turnberry, you know, a number of years ago, 1990, whatever it was now. But that was one of them. And I think the other one was really with the girls. You know, I mean, I taught Michelle Wee since she was the age of 13. You know, when she won the U.S. Open at Pinehurst, that was pretty special. I mean, look, she's always deemed for greatness and success, and really you have to look at her career as sort of as she underachieved. Because, I mean, this girl, I've never seen talent like this at a young age, boy or girl. I mean, when she was 13, 14, I can tell you, I mean, there was reasons why people thought that she should play the men's tour, because she hit it that far. I mean, she hit sky-high 3-irons with a X shaft in it, you know, and so it was amazing. And so, you know, when I first laid eyes on her, I thought, my goodness, this girl could be winning 8-10 tournaments a year. But, you know, fate plays a role. Injuries play a role. Maybe mismanagement plays a role. Who knows? You can always, there's always conjecture. She won 4 tournaments, including the US Open. So, I mean, you know, good career. Not great, but good. But you know, especially when you're chasing Annika, you know, with her record number of victories. So, but that was pretty special. It really was, because so she, you know, she pretty much was like a daughter to me, and you know, and so seeing her win that was good. So, you know, I mean, they're all special in their own rights, and so and you get a kick out of them, and, you know, before you know it, you're on to the next major, and, you know, that's history. So you got to get on with it. And so, you know, but as I say, I've had a lot of fun working with some of these great players through the years. And, you know, I'm only, as I say, you know, they're the horses, I'm the jockey. You know, jockeys shouldn't get as much credit as the horse, you know, so, which they don't do, you know, in the Kentucky Derby and what have you. And so I think sometimes, you know, coaches get too much credit, because, I mean, probably, you know, if they'd gone in a different direction, they probably would have done maybe just as well, if not better. You never know. I mean, but as I say, I played a role, certainly. And, you know, really when I came on the scene in the early to mid-80s, there really weren't many coaches about. I mean, you know, you had Jimmy Ballard, you had Bob Toski a little bit, you had John Jacobs in England. You know, you had Harvey Pettit, wasn't even heard of at that point, you know, although he worked with Ben Crenshaw and Tom Kite. But so, you know, I was sort of one of the, I don't know, pioneers in the coaching business. So it was a lot of fun over the years, going to all these tournaments, you know, and going around the world and helping players and so on. And as a result of all these players doing well, it sort of obviously helped my career. You know, Nick Faldo, it was obviously well chronicled, the 2-year period that we went through in order to make swing changes. And we're actually, yeah, we did a lot of instruction stuff back in the day with Sir Nick. I have to call him Sir Nick, you know, but the thing is, I still call him Nick. You know, the reason being, you know, he used to call me Lord Led. So a Lord outranks a Sir, I can assure you. Anyway, so we're thinking of maybe doing some instructional stuff, maybe, I told him with AI now, they can put his head on his old body, so he'll still look great, you know. But No, but being serious though, you know, it enabled me to honestly fulfill my dreams. I mean, I didn't fulfill them as a player, and certainly as a teacher and a coach, it was fun. I mean, you know, creating all these academies around the world, you know, writing books, you know, doing videos, bringing training aids out, you know. Yeah, I became a bit of a celebrity coach, really, which it was not my intention, but it just so happened. You know, people obviously thought that I must know something, having helped some of these people, you know, achieve what they achieved.
David, I wonder if you'd talk a little bit about, you mentioned about we've talked about the Golf Sun Ledbetter Academy at the top, and not only the great players that you've helped, but the recreational players and trying to improve their games. You've got a lot of locations around the world. It's not just domestic United States by any means. What teaching philosophies, if I were to go there, what should I expect from Golf Sun Ledbetter Academy?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, we go through a whole certification process, and that's something I was really insistent upon. We're going to open these academies. I didn't want people to teach like me, but I wanted them to have the Ledbetter philosophy, shall we say. And we call it a philosophy, not a method. A method tends to imply that it's only, you know, it's only one way to do things. And there's not. We know. Look at all the different players. I mean, swings are like fingerprints, right? And we're all different. You know, man, woman, junior, senior, good player, poor player, whatever, intermediate players. And so we have to find a way to, obviously, a big part of our instruction is communication and being able to analyze the individual and then tailor the instruction to the individual. Yeah, the problem is when you bring up books, you do videos, you do stuff on the internet, which is, there's a lot these days, by the way. You know, there's over 7 million pieces of advice on the golf swing on YouTube alone. So you can get pretty confused. So we really, you know, I've always believed in a simple approach. I mean, and I've always looked at, especially with, you know, we've been very focused on young players over the years, what I would call the holistic approach, looking not only at the technical side of the game, but the physical side, the mental side, the nutritional side, the spiritual side. And so, because you're trying to, especially these kids that come to us from all over the world, you know, you're trying to create a solid all-round person, not just a good golfer. Okay, that, I mean, yes, and we can help in that area. But I think, you know, golf lends itself to sort of really producing a type of individual that really, you know, let's face it, I mean, they're good guys. I mean, you don't get that many bad people in the game of golf. I mean, obviously you get a few. I'm not suggesting you don't, but generally speaking, and especially with kids, I think it's great. I mean, it's, you know, it's the first time that, you know, that a lot of things, a lot of the old things have gone out of the window now, you know, good manners and courtesy. I mean, where would you see somebody, hey, they finish the round, they shake hands, they take their caps off, and, you know, and that doesn't happen in anything else, in any other sport. In the old days it did, you know. I mean, these days people, you know, they wear whatever. I'm not saying, you know, I'm an old fuddy-daddy, but I mean, you know, walk into clubhouse, they got hats on and what have you, you know. Unless you're playing at Muirfield or something, which you'd be escorted probably off the property. But, you know, some of the traditions, you know, it's obviously important as far as I'm concerned. So getting back to your question there, Kelly, you know, I think, say, it's all about communication, talking in terms of, okay, some fundamentals. I know people talk about fundamentals, and but it is true. Look, okay, we're actually starting a program now, because I think most of the stuff on the internet, really, if you look at it, is probably geared 90% towards good players. It really is. So the average player, whether it be a beginner or a novice, has a hard time understanding what's going on. So we're sort of creating a program here where we're going to, you know, just really for the average to, you know, beginner, novice type player, so they can really develop their games. Because we know that people, even though, you know, the game's pretty healthy right now as a result of COVID, largely. But it's still a very difficult game. People have less time than they used to sort of play and practice. So we've got to try to get the message across. You know, I mean, yeah, I'm involved with all sorts of different products, like Sports Box, which is where you basically film somebody and can turn it into 3D. I mean, it's pretty amazing. And so, Things like that can really help to get the message across. But anyway, the program we're going to be running is like, because if I was a czar of golf, right, I would say categorically that nobody should be allowed to hit a ball for the first 6 to 8 weeks of their careers. Nobody should hit a ball, because you can develop the technique, the athleticism in a golf swing where you can't really go about doing it if you, the first thing you teach is a grip and get somebody to try to hit a ball, okay? Because if you hit a ball, it's probably luck more than anything else. Then the next thing is people concerned, why don't I hit every shot like that, okay? Now they're trying to lift the ball in the air. The ball's a big deterrent to progress, for sure. Think of it, you know, if you're going to learn to ballroom dance, I mean, you don't all of a sudden after 5 minutes go ahead and do the waltz. You just don't do it. I mean, it's like, hey, you learn to put one foot before the other and you move and you learn a little pattern and then you expand upon that. And that's exactly the way it should be in golf, like skiing, all right? If you go to learn to ski, you don't go to straight to the black moguls. You know, you start on the bunny slope. So, you know, I think there's an unrealistic approach with a lot of people. You know, they go out and play golf and their friends say, you know, keep your head down, keep your left arm straight and all this sort of nonsense. And therein lies the problem, because they're starting to create bad habits from the very start. So we're, you know, a lot of times we're certainly trying to undo some habits and renew some or redo some new ones. And so it's a all-encompassing question, that, because I don't know what we're going to teach somebody till we actually see them. I mean, we need to know their athleticism. We need to know, hey, what are their goals? What are their desires? How much time do they have to play and to practice? You know, I mean, you know, do they have the equipment that allows them to do this? So there's a lot of factors that go into determining, you know, what type of approach that we have. And that's why it's good for golfers to get hooked up with a solid teacher, solid instructor, whether it be at your club or wherever, and get on a program. I mean, that's the way to do it. That's how you get better. And if you know, it's sort of, especially juniors, I mean, you know, don't try and teach your kids. I mean, just, you know, put them with a good teaching professional, you know, somebody who has experience, say, with juniors, and get them on the right track, because now they've got fundamentals for life, okay? And that's really what, to me, is like, it's important. It's a game of a lifetime. And so, you know, the great thing about it is that the golf ball doesn't know how old we are, you know, so better, you know, good technique will stand the test of time, for sure.
David, what segment do you think is growing the fastest? Is it junior boys, junior girls, or something else? What do you think right now is enjoying the popularity of golf at the level that it is right now?
Well, I think women in general, but certainly junior girls, is really growing in leaps and bounds. I think that in the past, you've seen, you know, girls maybe take to golf at a later age. And, you know, I know my wife, Kelly, who played on the LPGA Tour for a number of years, she didn't start till she was 15. That doesn't happen very often, even though Nick Faldo and actually Greg Norman didn't start till they were 15, you know, and Larry Nelson when he was 21. But these days, I mean, look, you go to Arnold Palmer Hospital, they're already giving them the grip, you know, in the maternity ward, you know. So when they leave there, they've got a great, you know, overlap or interlocking grip, you know. So it's a prime start. But no, but I think that the women's market, I think they're starting to realize, you know, the fact that, hey, what golf can lead to, especially in the business world. You know, it's like, hey, you know, if somebody can play decent golf to a decent level, I mean, you know, some of the girls shock these men, you know. I mean, men to some extent say, oh, okay, we've got to play with Lucy. And all of a sudden, you know, Lucy bombs one out there 250 yards. It's like, oh my goodness, you know, I didn't expect that. And that's what you're seeing. I mean, you're seeing better athletes come into the sport. You're seeing, you know, obviously college golf is huge. I mean, the LPGA Tour is flourishing. I mean, you look at the countries around the world, where they're coming from, it's just incredible. So, you know, the US is sort of almost to some extent has to catch up, because the foreigners on the LPGA Tour have really led the way. You look at Korea. I mean, you know, I was highly involved with Seri Park when she first came over to this country, right? So that was late 90s now, 99, I think. And, you know, obviously she went on to have a phenomenal career. But the first 3 years I was working with Seri, I mean, she literally was the only Korean girl over here. But then she, when she started having her success, I mean, it just, the game caught on like wildfire over there, especially amongst the female population. So it's really interesting how the game has grown in leaps and bounds. And I would say the female aspect, say especially the young girls, I'm involved, I'm on the board of the American Junior Golf Association. I can see how, the girls' tournaments have really flourished and are growing. So it's good to see it because we want everybody playing this game. I mean, it's got to be a family sport, and we want men, women, seniors, juniors, everybody playing. I mean, that's what it's all about, and getting more people out there to play. And even the fact that now, the golf, screen golf they call it in Asia, or simulator golf, I mean, it's becoming seriously popular. I mean, we've got these facilities up in New Jersey, and we're opening more. They just opened one in Beijing, golf zone, have called Golf City. Okay, this is a over 100,000 square foot building, and they've got 18 holes. Okay, 18 simulators with different greens. So you're basically you're playing an 18-hole golf course indoors. And I mean, believe you me, if you've been in Beijing, you want to be indoors with that air quality, But the interesting thing, this is something Golf Zone have got planned to do all over the world. I mean, apart from just, obviously we have things like Topgolf now and some such things, and lots of there's lots of simulators out there now. But it's really interesting how golf has taken on a different look. And it's, I think it's obviously from a time factor, from the fact that, golf is expensive, and to travel out of cities, if you're in Asia, if you're in Tokyo, for instance, there's a, you're probably traveling by car for 2 hours, to a golf course, and then, another 2 hours back. So it's an all day deal. Here it's like, hey, you play 18 holes and, under 2 hours. So it's phenomenal. I say how the game is changing shape, but yet at the same time, it's maintaining a lot of its old, the old integrity and the old sort of ways, if you will.
Wow. I mean, such fascinating insights, David. David Ledbetter joining us here on Musings on Golf. And yeah, that's a really cool thing for our game, isn't it? That it, I remember when I was with the PGA of America and Play Golf America was first coming around. And the whole premise was it doesn't have to be 18 holes. You can go and play nine. You can hit balls. You can play with your spouse on a Thursday afternoon, play six holes, have, dinner afterward. And it's, as you said, it's now gone to very different levels with the top golfs of the world. David, that's only good for our game, isn't it?
Why is it 18? Oh, why should it be? I mean, it's the old Scotsman having 18 swishes of, of whiskey, And so, so if you listen to Robin Williams, he'll explain it. But I mean, Jack Nicklaus was very much in favor of designing three 6-hole courses to make him 118 type thing. And so, yeah, just to get out and play a few holes. I mean, look, there's nothing like being outdoors for sure. I mean, obviously, indoors is the next best thing. Nothing like being outdoors in the fresh air and playing on a well maintained golf course, or even if it's not that well maintained, just being outdoors is great. And so, if you can walk, so much the better. But golf is a game. Obviously, it's played at all ages, and so I just think that promoting the game in all these different ways now, I think is really, really great. I mean, my daughter Allie is sort of a golf influencer now.
Oh, yeah.
Being on, and it's really interesting looking at all this, because a few years ago I thought, what are they doing? But now it's a big deal. All these influencers that, I mean, FedEx Championship, they had a like a pro-am day with all the influencers there. And I think, they got more viewers there than they did during the first round of the tournament, because these people are really popular, especially amongst the young. And so we can bring it to, different demographics. I think, I'm all for it.
How'd you get to know Nick Faldo?
Sir Nick Faldo. Okay, so I first met Nick at a tournament I was playing in. We were playing. Okay, so this is going way back. In fact, I went to see the course. We took the family over to Africa. I hadn't been back for a lot of years. And we were at a golf course up at Victoria Falls. Okay, so really one of the seven wonders of the world. And so there was a golf course there designed by Gary Player called Elephant Hills Country Club, which is just being remodeled right now. And it was right on the banks of the Zambezi. So humidity was certainly going through the roof. And Nick was playing in it. In fact, Tony Jacklin was playing it as well. I remember sitting on the bus with him, sort of thinking, well, he'd offer it. This was in the early 70s, and you know, he'd won the US Open and the Open. And so, you know, I was sort of chuffed that was playing in the same tournament as Tony Jacklin. But anyway, but I met Sir Nick there. He came over and he was playing. I mean, he's probably only 18 or 19 at the time. He just turned professional and, you know, had obviously a good amateur record, although he didn't turn pro until fairly late. But then I think through the years, I mean, at tournaments, et cetera, et cetera. And I think he approached me because I, you know, obviously the work that I did with Nick Price and, you know, people like Dennis Watson back in the day, my good friend, he saw the success, and I think he was frustrated with his game, and he realized that, look, and his whole goal was to win a major, and he came to me and said, look, can you help me win the Open? And so I took note of his game. I mean, he was a guy that put a lot of spin on the ball, and I thought, well, if you're going to win an Open, somehow he's going to take a lot of spin off it, because, you know, that's not going to work well in the wind. I remember walking with him at the Masters, this is prior to we started working, and seeing some of his tee shots. I mean, obviously it was a lot of attack angle down because the ball went up, spun, hit the fairway, and literally came back a few yards. You know, the fairways were wet, I remember, but still, you know, so I said, yeah, I've got some ideas I think could really help you. So he said, okay. And he basically said, hey, throw the book at me. And so I said, okay, well, you know, this is something that it's going to take a little while. If you're prepared to do that, he says, hey, I'll do whatever it takes. And he'd already won Hilt Head by that time, and won tournaments in, on the European Tour, or the DP Tour that is today. So it was quite a, you know, a thing for him to do. So, and but boy, he stuck at it. I stuck at it, and you know, literally, you know, we figured about, okay, this is going to be probably a 2-year project, and then it wasn't. It was like, probably a month shy of 2 years, or maybe 1 month after 2 years, but it was about a 2-year time frame. And where he won in 1987, he won at Muirfield. And, you know, everybody remembers it more for the fact that he had 18 pars in the last round to win it. Yeah. So that was really the start. And then he won 6 majors and obviously competed well in others, you know, was, you know, lost in a player for the US Open to Curtis Strange. And so, I mean, he had obviously a tremendously successful career. And, you know, I was very fortunate because that really sort of really kickstarted my career. And in the beginning, you know, when I was working with him, and especially in Britain, my name was, you know, Mud. Who's destroying our, you know, star player and da-da-da-da-da. But, you know, things soon changed after you won the major. Amazing what success does.
Hey, I want to ask you that. So did you realize that it could take as long as 2 years? That's a long time. And he had to have been a very disciplined mindset, David, to be willing to kind of go through that process. That's not an easy process to go through.
No, and it wouldn't work today. Let's face it. There's no chance.
Right. No chance.
This is just way too much on it. There's, you know, I mean, whether it be top 50 in the world or, you know, exempt to this tournament, that tournament. I mean, yeah, the first year he nearly lost his car. The last tournament of the year was at Disney. And I remember he had to play well. And I think he finished top 10 or something to keep his card. So that's how close it was, you know. But it was one of those things. We just sort of plucked the number out of the sky. I said, well, listen, this is not an overnight thing. If you want to really make some change, because he had very much an old style golf swing, very high hand, you know, big slide with the hips, big reverse C, you know, some, you know, bit of the old Jack Nicklaus, Johnny Miller sort of cross between type thing. And so, you know, that we went about sort of what we call rounding his swing off, getting it more level rather than sort of as vertical as it was. And that enabled him to bring the ball flight down and control the spin. You know, I mean, look, if we'd had things like TrackMan and what have you back in the day, it would have shortened the process considerably, but we didn't. And it was sort of my eye, and fortunately video had, you know, just been out for a while. So we use a lot of film and a lot of comparisons. And so, you know, I fortunately always had a pretty good eye, in my opinion. One of my good friends who's a leading biomechanist, he said, David, you're very fortunate because you have biomechanical eyes. And so what he meant by that was I sort of had an instinctive feeling of that we were on the right tracks. I mean, it was a little bit of trial and error. I mean, you know, I would be kidding to say it wasn't, you know, so you know, that doesn't work so well, let's try this. And also the fact that I was working with other players at the time, you know, you get, you know, my greatest students or my greatest learning came from my students. So whether it be high handicappers or what, because what works for one doesn't necessarily work for another. So you become a little bit more versatile in your teaching and your coaching. So and that sort of helped. And so, and I was always a great student of the game. Look, I qualified for the European Tour by a stroke. So that sort of set my stall up, so to speak, as far as, I mean, I always enjoyed teaching. I mean, look, I turned pro when I was 17. I mean, I left, I was sort of partly a school, but I was a professional. And I started teaching when I was 17, 18. You know, I didn't know what I was doing, but it was all, you know, I mean, actually, cut out magazine articles and, you know, oh, hey, you know, here's an article on Doug Saunders. This work on swinging it short today and see what happens, you know? So it's like, it was a trial and error, you know?
That's what you had back then, right? That's all you had.
Yeah, in many ways. I mean, and all the books, you know, I'm a big book buff. We're in my office now. I've got, you know, a whole library here of books dating back to the 19th century, you know, on instruction. And, we're still trying to figure out how to get that little ball in the hole. You know, used to be trying to get featheries in the hole. Now it's obviously, you know, the latest and greatest golf ball. But I've always been very imaginative. You know, I've always come up with drills and exercises, which I think honestly quicken the process. You know, Nick Faldo was certainly great at doing the drill. People remember seeing him with a beach ball between his knees and Fanny pushing him from behind, doing certain drills. Because I say, to me, there's three ways that you improve. One is giving somebody a concept. Another one is giving him a visual, an image, whether it be on video, a mirror, or whatever the case may be. And the third is feel. And the feel is something you really want to give somebody because that's what they want to go out and play with. You know, people get too technical on the golf course. But, you know, having a feel is this fun.
David, you hear a lot about the athlete, it doesn't really matter the sport, who maybe hangs on a little too long. They want one more year. Now, you didn't have the success playing professionally that I'm sure you wanted to. Was that an adjustment? Obviously, teaching was important to you, but how did you reconcile in your mind, doggone it, I'm not good enough as a player, but boy, I can be really good, I think, as a teacher?
Well, I think I realized that I found teaching, I don't mean to sound crass about it, but I found teaching really easy. You know, I could see somebody sum up what I think they needed to do. And, you know, that's how I teach. I create a model in my mind, how I think that particular person with their particular build should swing the club. And I work towards that model. And I found it really, really easy. With a touch of sense, my grandfather was one of Britain's leading osteopaths and he was blind. And so people would come from all over Europe to see him, and he had this magic touch. You know, my mother said, well, you inherited some of it from him. So whether that be the case or not, I don't know. But anyway, teaching was always easy. So it was one of those things that, as much as I loved playing, you know, I was a great practicer. I mean, you know, but unfortunately, you don't win tournaments on the practice tee, you know. And so, you know, I think I would have had a more, you know, I'm not saying would have been successful, but I would have had a more of a successful playing career if I knew mentally what I know now. Because, you know, you apply things differently. I think because of my inquisitive mind, I think I was constantly trying things and working on things. And so in some respects, which helped my teaching, because, you know, you try this, you try that, and you figure out, well, that works. No, that doesn't work. I mean, you know, I remember, you know, reading Ben Hogan's book, The Modern Fundamentals, which is still the biggest seller in golf, which probably confused more people than anything else, particularly with his grip, you know. And so I remember I tried that weak grip up in the palm, and, you know, man, and I persevered with it for months. I said, I just can't do this. It's impossible. Even though, you know, he obviously purported to be the greatest ball striker of all time, and still in some instances, you know, Nick just and Gary Player say the same thing, that, you know, he was the greatest ball striker. Well, yeah, that might have been good for him. And then you realize, you know, the guy had unbelievable flexibility, had some left-handedness in him. And he did things with his body that most people couldn't do, you know, as far as setting the club, for instance. So he put the club up in his palm, or to almost to inhibit excessive wrist action. Because if you look at his early swings prior to his accident, he had a pretty long swing. I mean, that club was way below parallel. And so, you know, as he, you know, with his accident, I think it probably shortened his swing. And then with his grip change, he felt that, hey, he had, you know, more, for want of a better term, more passive hands, and he eradicated his hook. So, but that was fine. And you know, that was the written word back then. And so, you know, Hogan's book was like, wow, that was gospel. It must be right. Well, it sure didn't work for everybody, you know. And I actually wrote a book on Ben Hogan. They found the photograph that they took of him, and I wrote a book, and pretty much giving my opinions. And you know, I think Ben Hogan wrote a lot of what he felt, even though he did use cine camera back in the day. He was one of the first to use it, but he wrote pretty much what he felt rather than what he did. And so, and that can be a problem too. If you know, that's why it's difficult. It's difficult learning, you know, from a video. And I mean, it might suit some people. It's like difficult learning it on the internet, because you don't know whether it applies to you. What we feel we do and what we actually do are two different things. We all know that. And so I say, there's nothing better than just getting one-on-one with the teacher and really getting down and dirty with it. But so, you know, that's a long-winded answer, but I made the right choice. I certainly did. And I've loved every minute of it. People say, hey, how would you change things? And I really wouldn't. You know, I met my wife through golf. You know, I met great people through golf. I've traveled the world. I've had a lot of fun, played some great golf courses, and, you know, managed to look after my family. And so, and through golf, I mean, it's meant everything. And I'm just thrilled with the, you know, the career that I've had.
Well, it certainly has been a pleasure. I know you wrote 8 books. Is it?
Just written 9th book.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, just written my 9th. Yeah, it's called Fix It Yourself. You know, so it's like, if I walk by on the tee there, somebody says, hey, can you have a look at my swing? I'm going to throw the book at him and say, hey, fix it yourself.
I got
a new one coming out, Bob. It's called How to Take the Stress Out of Your Fourth Putt. Yeah, that one's going to be really popular.
Is there one book that stands out for you?
Yeah, probably the first one, called The Golf Swing. You know, I mean, The Golf Swing was, I actually started on Ben Hogan's book, not the content, but the actual style. It was broken down into sections. I had David Frost as the model, you know, had a great golf swing. And that sold, I don't know, close to 500,000 copies. And it was during, you know, the time where, you know, Nick Faldo started to really come into prominence. And so, yeah, that probably, I mean, and the thing is, we still use that book as a basis for our instruction. And so have I changed, evolved some? Yeah, I have. I mean, you know, golf's a power game now. We're looking at, you know, all sorts of things. I mean, you know, probably, you know, if people looked at players like Jim Furyk's swing action or Scotty Scheffler's foot action, you know, people, you know, they, you know, Johnny Miller made a comment, I think, years ago about Craig Harry at Doral, you know, and he said, man, if, you know, Ben Hogan and seeing that swing would turn over in his grave, you know. So, you know, there's a little bit more, you know, individuality looking at things now, looking at the athleticism rather than just purely the style. Yeah, everybody looks at Adam Scott and says, hey, what a great golf swing. Or Ernie Els, why? Because of the beautiful rhythm. You know, I think the best golf swing, I think personally, I mean, look, I love Rory's swing. I think he's got a couple little, in my opinion, flaws that probably maybe hurt him with his short irons, which I think is, if you look at the stats, it proves that. But my personal favorite swing now is Ludwig Åberg. I mean, I think that golf swing is magnificent. I mean, it's simple. It's to the point. He's no messing around. I mean, it's just, and he's not very technical either.
Hey, David, what are those flaws that you see in Rory on the irons?
You know, it's to get into it. I mean, to me, he's got a bit of a synchronization issue, which doesn't really affect the driver. Okay, I mean, you know, a lot of people don't realize, but the swing, the driver swing is different to the iron swing, right? Because A, we're ending up on it, and B, we're ending down on it, right? And so I think that at times what happens is, you know, he talks about getting stuck when the club gets behind him, and especially if he's trying to take something off it, you know, with the short irons. I mean, say he's not. I always look at history, okay, and I think the great players of the different eras, thing they have in common, they're all great iron players, all of them, okay, because let's face it, you've got a lot of different situations that crop up with your iron play, okay, different lies, in between yardages, et cetera, et cetera. So all the greats, you know, I'm talking about one multi-majors, have all been really, really top iron players. And I say the statistics, that's a hard word to say, don't actually bear that out with Rory as much. I mean, you know, obviously he has a lot of great shots, and I mean, his way he drives the ball, why has that guy not dominated the game like Tiger? It's incredible to me. I mean, because, and that's 10 years ago, I mean, when he was 25, you know, and so, you know, we all have our theories. I mean, look, he's a different build now to what he was back then. He's bulked up tremendously, and, you know, and, as I say, I think it was interesting that, you know, he went to see Butch, and Butch was working on his tape work, because I think, to me, I think, personally, the two big faults in the swing for amateurs is the grip, and for every other player, including amateurs, I think the takeaway is the most important thing, because that sets the stage for your whole swing. I think the way that Rory works the club away from his body, gets a big gap between the club and his body, creates a problem, because now it sort of travels on a, it's almost like, I liken it, if you're a 400-meter runner and you happen to change lanes, and then you get back into your lane, you're actually running probably 405 meters, okay, yeah. That was allowed, you know, but the hypothetical, obviously. But the fact of the matter is, when your body moves as aggressively as Rory's does, you've always got to have the club, what we call it, in front of you coming down. The arms and the body really have to sync up. And I think that's where he gets into trouble. And I mean, because I've witnessed it and seen it, and we've all seen it, where he's missed greens with wedges or nine irons or hit it 30, 40 feet. You know, and if you're hitting it 10 or 15 feet, and just, you know, look at Scotty's statistics. I mean, he's up there. I mean, he and Rory almost identical on the driver with strokes gained. But with the irons, there's no comparison, you know, really, especially from the 100 to 175 range, which is obviously what Rory's going to be hitting a lot of those shots. And it reminds me a little bit, sad to say, of Greg Norman, who bullied the world with his driving. He was probably one of the greatest drivers of the ball in the world, along with Jack Nicklaus. And so, but, you know, for him to only win two majors, where were the problems? Okay, well, the problems, if you look at it, was with his iron play. I mean, you've seen, you know, how many irons he sort of screwed back off greens and missed greens and so on and so forth. So, you know, when you think of a player with that talent that he win two majors, and you just hope that Rory doesn't go down the same path, because he's too talented. I mean, I just love watching that guy swing when he's in full flow. And he's actually a good putter. I mean, Brad Faxon's helped him tremendously with his putting. I mean, he's brilliant around the greens, you know, amazing out of bunkers. And so, but it's just like when he has a short iron in his hand, yeah, if he hits it close, oh, good. But, you know, there's always that sort of holding your breath thinking, well, I wonder where this one's going to end up. Is it going to end up close? Is it not? You know, I mean, yeah, of course he hits good shots. But he's won, you know, zillions of dollars and, you know, 40 tournaments around the world and four majors. I think somebody with visibility level is underachieving. That's my personal feeling. I mean, look, people can always argue the fact that, okay, that's wrong, that's David Ledbetter's opinion, but, you know, I've seen the greats through the years. I always think, could you imagine if you put Nick Faldo's iron play with Greg Norman's driving?
What? Never lose. What
would you have had? Yeah, would have won every major, basically, you know. So, yeah. You know, assuming one of them could putt, you know. But it's all conjecture. We always sort of look at stuff, and we all, you know, I mean, I have to listen to sort of the Golf Channel, and hey, they're always hypothesizing, aren't they? You know, I mean, it's like, okay, and sometimes they're completely wrong, and you know, sometimes they're right, But I mean, I think that's the nature of the game. We sit around, you know, after the rounds, and we discuss and we talk, and, you know, it's all part of the camaraderie of the game. And, you know, it's, And it, you know, hopefully that doesn't end, and it's, it won't do, because everybody has an opinion. I mean, especially now with the internet, everybody can write their opinion, and you know, some of them not so nice, but you know, some of them probably have some merit. But anyway, you know, it's the world's changing, Bob, from when, you know, we were sort of at our peak, shall we say. Something's good, something's bad, you know.
Sure, David.
Two quick questions. One, David, I've overlooked Ernie Els. You worked with him for a long time, and that's not fair to him. The sweet swing that we see now, was that always there with Els? How much of your work, your creativity went into Ernie's success?
Okay, so I saw Ernie when he came over here when he was 19. So he's, what, 55 now? Okay, so I told you, 36 years ago, right? Look, he always had that rhythm. His dad sort of drilled it into him, okay, low and slow. I mean, it was pretty simple stuff. I always say, having come from that part of the world, to some extent, I always say, you know, South Africans and people from that neck of the woods, they have to keep things simple for them. You know, they don't want to make it too complicated. So Ernie was, it was very simple in the way that he went about it. And what we did was, honestly, not to change anything about his rhythm, nothing. And so it was all about just getting the club in a better position. You know, Ernie used to get the club laid off a little bit. And through the years, it was just a maintenance thing. You know, once we established, once again, it went back to the takeaway. You know, Ernie was a little bit of he sort of separated, and that's when the club got laid off at the top. But, you know, he always had this, he just had, you know, he's a great athlete. He was great playing other sports, whether it be rugby or tennis or, you know, and golf, obviously, that he was very successful at. And so, you know, he was just unfortunate that he was born in came around the Tiger era. You know, I mean, how many majors would he and Phil Mickelson, for that matter, would they have won if Tiger wasn't around? You know, that'd be interesting. But so he's always had that look. And, you know, I always felt that he was going to be like Sam Snead, that his swing was going to be oily and last forever. And so it's proved. I mean, you know, he's still playing some great golf out there on the Champions Tour, you know, and with the equipment, et cetera, hasn't lost much length either, you know. And so, yeah, with Ernie, he's always had a, you know, few issues with his putting here and there, and which, you know, he's certainly been a great putter at times, but, you know, it's comes and goes. But he's brilliant around the greens too. You know, I always remember, you know, watching for hours chipping and pitching. He never mishit a shot. It was one of those things, every shot was flush, you know. And so when you're able to do that, you can read those shots. In other words, if you've got a little pitch and run, you know how the ball's going to react. So he had, you know, great imagination. And so it was a case really of, I suppose in a nutshell, not screwing him up, you know, not trying to change anything. And so, that's, you know, we had a pretty long relationship. In fact, he still sends me swings periodically. And so we look at it, and, you know, I watch, you know, I see something on the broadcast, I sort of said it to him. So, you know, we don't get together that regularly, but, you know, he says, you know, that stuff, you know, in this South Africa, that stuff we used to work on still works great, you know. So it's like, you know, so, and so, you know, he was one of those guys that you just see, you know, I mean, he's going to play well into his 60s for sure, you know, it's not longer, you know, it's just got just one of those beautiful golf swings that, you know, easy power, you know, that's what he's always doing, he had, you know.
David, you've been so great with your time. One final question from me before I turn it over to Bob. It's a question we ask all of our guests. If you could round out a sort of a magical dream foursome with three other players, whether they're living or deceased, who would those three be? And it could be family members, it could be stars of the game, whoever. Who would they be, and where would you play that round of golf?
Okay. Well, I think I'd play at Royal County Down. It's one of my favorite golf courses in Northern Ireland, you know. And so it's a beautiful golf course. I'm sure a lot of people, you know, or listen to this, have played it. It's brilliant. So three favorite players. Okay. Well, I'd just put Ben Hogan in, because I really never got him to actually see him hit balls, you know. So, I mean, you know, if he was still around, I'd love to. I think you have to put Ben Hogan in there. I think you'd put, let's see, who else would I put? I'd put, I'd actually put, because he, you know, he's a, you know, I grew up sort of, we all did, idolizing him in Southern Africa, Gary Player, okay? Because Gary Player, to me, he's one of the most positive individuals. You know, he's one of those guys that once you leave him, say, man, you feel good, you feel energized, you know? I mean, there's probably a lot of, you know what, in there, but it's still one of those things that he is an amazing individual. I mean, he's going to be 90 this year. You know, I mean, he's always talking about how many sit-ups he's doing and everything else, and, you know, his health. I mean, he definitely talks the talk, but he walks the walk as well. So he's a great, you know, role model for many people. So he would be another. And then probably I put my wife Kelly in there, you know, because we probably haven't played enough golf over the years, and, you know, she normally kicked my ass anyway. So the thing is, excuse my language, but I'd put her in there because she would have loved to have played with Nick Price. I remember Gary Player, he wasn't overly fond of her when he first met her because she told him he was doing his sit-ups wrong, you know. So she went put her head in his back, said, no, keep your back like that when you do sit-ups, because she's all about form, because she trains with Pilates and all sorts of stuff. And so I think Gary was taken aback by that, but still, I think she'd like to play with him. So anyway,
that's awesome.
Well, let me wrap it up by the exact way I started. You've only added to the mystique of David Ledbetter, and that is better, nobody any better than David Ledbetter. Thanks for joining us on Musings, David. Great catching up with you again.
Thanks, Bob. Thanks, Kelly.
You've been a dear friend for a long time, and somebody I truly admire, and we appreciate your time.
Thank you so much, and you take care now, Bob, and Kelly, thank you.
Just like you, I want to look good and perform at my best on the golf course, and that's exactly why I wear the new WH golf shoes from William & Harry, and you should too. Folks, I love these golf shoes. They're made of deer skin and calf skin. They've got a soft gel insert, and the reinforced hardened soft spikes increase stability and balance. And I got to tell you, they are so incredibly comfortable. So head on over to williamandharry.com to check out the new WH golf shoe. Look your best, play your best with William & Harry. Bob, what a fascinating individual David Ledbetter is on so many fronts, right?
Oh, just fascinating. And like I say, we've had a good 30-year relationship. I've always respected him. I admired him. And one of the real good guys in the world of professional golf.
Hey, Bob, it is Halloween again, so I'm going to throw a couple items out at you and see what you think about this. So they asked tour players, what's the scariest hole at Augusta National? And, you know, you come to mind and say, well, a tee shot at number 12 could be, you know, with all the wind whipping around. But by far, the long, challenging dogleg left par 4 11th hole with that water lurking to the left. Boy, that is just one great, scary golf hole, Bob.
Well, I think the average person would probably say number 12. But as you know, Kelly, having talked to the players for a good number of years, it's actually number 11.
And for every good reason. A great hole in terms of the design, the water lurking down to the left. Yeah, you have some bailout, Bob, over to the right. But even with that, you're still hitting back at the water on the third shot. If you could make par every hole, every time you play the 11th at Augusta National over the 4 days of the Masters, that would be a dream come true. Most terrifying first tee shot in golf. Bob, this doesn't come as any surprise. You and I have both been on the first tee of a Ryder Cup. Ain't nothing like it, Robert.
No, you're so right about that, Kelly Elvin. Most terrifying shot to me in the Ryder Cup is that first tee shot. It's hard to explain how the player is feeling. He knows he's representing his country. The crowd is going wild, and he's got to come up and execute that first shot. And there's no doubt that it's the most frightening shot when they play the Ryder Cup. It's that first tee shot.
All right, let's talk real quick on treats to close this out. I've got a favorite foursome of Halloween candies, Robert. I'm not sure how much candy you're eating these days, but if you could give me these four, if you could give me Snickers, Reese's Peanut Butter Cups, I love the Butterfinger. If you give me the Butterfinger and those little Tootsie Roll Midgies, if I could get those in my little orange pumpkin that I'm going to be carrying around later. And the fifth, kind of if you go with a fivesome here, love the York Peppermint Patties. But if I can get those, I'm a happy trick-or-treater. What do you think?
Well, it's easy for me because I don't eat chocolate and I don't eat candy. But if I had to pick, I'm certainly going to pick anything chocolate because that's the favorite of Janice Self, our lovely executive producer.
Happy Halloween. No show next week. There's a lot going on. We encourage everyone to vote, whether you're voting early or on election day. Robert, happy Halloween to you, to Janice, to everyone. Thanks for joining us on Musings on Golf.